So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review way.
Colbert was waffled by the chair, blinded by the mace of this jabroni fan in the front row. And now totally, and the Sarge is gone.
That's got to be it.
Oh, no.
1, 2.
It's over. Tony, my God, it's over.
I can't believe it. His career is done.
Colbert's done.
Colbert has lost.
I thought it was just a matter of time. I thought that he would get to 177, and it wasn't Sarge.
This is our flagship. This cannot happen like this. Not in the hands of a punk who came in.
Fans,
it's eerily quiet here. Fans stunned in disbelief.
I never once in a million years thought that.
God, we have seen the end of the era.
He got to be the world champion.
3 years.
41,000 there in Atlanta at the Dome. And it ends here in Indianapolis. Now, I don't want this to be the last visual image of this phenomenal athlete that saved the company. That when they thought that, you know, the NWO was over and we couldn't come back, it was Goldberg that kept us up, that kept us on top, and to see it in this way, at the hands of a piece of scum like Mark Bagwell and Lex Luger.
We don't know what to say, but next is the four-way dance.
So.
Welcome to Review Away, the home edition. It is John Pollock alongside Wei Ting. Wei, how are you doing? You do not look great.
What?
You look worn out. You look like you've just lived through the seven deadly sins.
I'm kind of, I don't know. What else is new? I don't want to, people don't want to hear me complain about how tired I am. I'm watching Breaking Bad.
Lately. Oh, no. So you're into meth now.
No.
Maybe that's why.
No, I'm not into meth.
So it's not staff that you've been dealing with when you have to put like a bandage on your nose or something like that. It's meth marks.
I don't think you shoot meth through the forehead.
Isn't that one of the...
Smoke meth.
Yeah.
I don't even know what you do. But
How do guys get all those scabs and shit on their face that are like meth addicts?
Aren't those like...
I am not well versed in meth.
No, you're not, eh? Me neither.
We'll try it 1 week. See how it does.
I don't think so.
Never mind.
But that show is almost as addictive as meth.
Wow.
So I was smoking up a bunch of episodes of Breaking Bad, and I think it's like, man, it's such a depressing show. It just like affects my mood.
So how deep into season one are you, or are you going to tell us something crazy like you're on season two already?
I'm at season three, but
you're on season three.
Yeah.
Did you just start the series?
I started maybe like 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago?
A week and a half ago, maybe.
Holy shit.
Yeah. What? That's not...
That's
not
a lot, man.
People finish this show in like a week. Anyway...
How many episodes are in a season?
It varies. But the first season was like 8 episodes.
Oh, okay.
They're like hour-long episodes, so they're not short, but I just find like... I just watch it when I can, but even then, they always end in cliffhangers, so you can't just stop at the end of one episode. You gotta stop it like when there's at least some type of resolution.
Oh,
and just to wait for that takes a long time. So, I find these shows are like they kind of depress the shit out of me. There's always like bad stuff happening to this guy.
Yeah,
and so I've gotten to the point now where okay, it's bugging me so much. I don't have that much time. I find like I'm not going to sleep because of this thing. So I just started reading spoilers. I just started reading ahead. And it takes me like maybe like 5 minutes to read a synopsis. I'm like, okay, I'm satisfied. Get done.
And then you'll skip that episode?
Oh, I'll probably watch it eventually later, but it's just like, I don't know. I just want to get rid of it. You're losing this isn't an enjoyment.
This sounds like this is an endurance.
This is exactly why I don't start TV shows, because it becomes a commitment, and it is enjoyable, but at the same time it's too time consuming.
Wow. Well, I went through that with Sons of Anarchy, and now I'm all caught up to Sons of Anarchy, so I have nothing to watch. I did start The Sopranos recently. I watched the entire first season. Now I'm on to season two.
How long did that take you?
I watched that first season in during my trip to Hawaii, so over the course of a week and a half.
Okay.
So that was fun. Nice. In terms of depressing shows, though, I don't watch the show, but my wife does. Parenthood. Have you heard of this show?
No.
It's with Laura Graham?
I don't know.
The attractive woman who's 40. Craig T. Nelson's in it. Usually, she'll have this on. So I just, you know, when I hear it on, this is the most depressing show. Nothing, it's like about this family that has all these different members, and it's just how bad their lives are. Everything is bad. A wife is cheating on her husband, a child, he's like, they have this child who's autistic, so that's really depressing in how he interacts with the world around him. It's like the grandfather and grandmother want to get a divorce. It's just depressing. There's no happy moments at all on this show. It's like when Russo was booking Impact. There was nothing ever happy. There was ever that kind of solace that you would take in watching the show, and you'd get those happy moments, which would juxtapose the depressing moments, the cliffhangers. Yeah. It's all terrible. I wouldn't want to be part of this parenthood.
And do you keep watching it?
I don't watch it. I just, you know, every now and then I'm out here working and the show will be on, and it's impossible to ignore.
But I think, you know, obviously...
It's just tears and yelling. That's what the show should be called.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, you need drama for a drama, of course. Usually that's depressing.
Yeah, but to me, I like shows where you get to see people have a bond, have great moments, because then when bad stuff happens... You remember the good times, and now it's the complete opposite.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're starting it negative, how much more negative can we get?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you have the negative to build to a resolution.
Like sometimes we review a great show from the WWF in 2000, mm-hmm. and we feel great about things. We review Kenta Kobashi's, some of his career highlight matches.
Yeah.
And then we review Sin. So people get the comparisons. They see us at a high... And they see us at lows. You see?
I suppose, yeah.
You see? They see us go up and down. We're like a roller coaster.
Yeah, I suppose so. We're like, yeah, these reviews are just like life.
Now, Sin, I'm not even going to ask you if you watched this before this show. I imagine this was your first viewing of said pay-per-view. The first and only Sin. Well, not the first and only Sin of WCW's history, but of pay-per-view names.
Yeah, the first time. This Probably was the only time.
Yeah. I have this one on VHS if you ever do want it down the road.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I would say the most newsworthy event on this entire pay-per-view was not the fact that Sid shattered his leg. It's that if you were watching this pay-per-view, you never saw the actual incident till the next night on Nitro. They were cut away to a segment in the back at the time. And you come back and Sid's dead.
They missed the best part of it.
Worse.
It's not the best part. I shouldn't say that. It is a truly horrific incident.
Were you a sick fuck like I was and looked this up online after?
No. I don't think I heard about it. I mean, I heard about it, but I didn't go out.
I remember seeing this on Nitro, and that's the segment I pulled up on YouTube. The announcers tell us about Sid's injury, and then they show us the replay. Then they zoom in and do it in slow motion. Then they do an even slower motion version. They must have shown this thing 4 times in a row. And make sure to get the crowd. The crowd, you can hear them go, ooh. Yeah. And it gets louder and louder with each replay. I was shaking watching it. I had to turn my head away. It was so gruesome.
Yeah, like limb breaks are...
I can't do them, man.
They're one of those things that are acceptable to show, but it's very easy to cross the line. Because, you know, certain things you obviously would be very distasteful to show, like a decapitation. That's beyond any limits. I don't care if you're a news channel. I don't think anybody should ever show a dick decapitation. That's disgusting. Even a limb, any type of limb getting cut off. That's ridiculous.
Oh,
but a
limb is somehow.
This is, you know, this is close to that. It's a limb getting cut off, but the skin's still attached.
Oh God. And was this one more was this more violent than Anderson Silva, having watched both now over the past month or so?
I mean, it's
hard
to say, because I mean I was so far removed because I had already seen this.
I think Sid's looked worse.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Ugh.
But Sid's was probably
like
worse.
A fucking 90-degree turn of his foot.
Sid's was probably worse because he kept working the match.
Oh, and they fucking kicked him.
Yeah.
Imagine Chris Weidman getting on top and kicking Anderson Silva.
That's the thing.
Oh,
wrestling is so ridiculous that way. But I feel like, you know, more eyeballs were obviously on the Anderson Silva leg break, and it just kind of happened with the scream. Sid here just, he just like, he was in shock. He just laid there.
He had to have been. Because yeah. He was about as composed as a man could be in that state. If that was me, dude, I would be yelling to the goddamn heavens. Like, yeah. Just, I would be crying. Yeah. I would be yelling in fear.
Yeah.
I would not be calm. And the last thing on my mind would be, well, we got to finish the match. Fuck you all. We're not finishing. Fuck all. You get me on a goddamn stretcher right now, or I'm suing everybody in this building.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
I'm not a pro wrestler.
Yeah, yeah. It's pro wrestling is just so incredibly weird that way. But which one was more horrific? I mean, the debate goes on. That's like,
let us know on the message board, folks.
They're both bad. Is this one of those things that's even right to joke about?
I don't think we're joking about it. We're talking about two graphic injuries.
I know, but even to like compare, it's like, okay, it's like saying, oh, whose death was the worst.
But
death.
Neither person died here. I mean, this was a horrific injury, obviously.
But I'm just saying, like, sometimes, you know, people regard accidents like this almost to, like they're near-death experiences.
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of overstating it. It wasn't a near-death experience. It was a horrific injury, and one that ultimately Sid did, I won't say fully recover from. I don't think he was ever probably at 100% that he was before this match. But he did wrestle again after this.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Years later, he would come back.
Did you know his son was on a season of Big Brother?
He was, yeah. I never watched it.
Yeah.
Did you ever see it?
No, but
I That'll be your next binge show.
No, not Big Brother.
Nope.
I used to be big into Big Brother.
Big into Brother.
Yeah, big into Brother.
That's actually a porn title.
Yes,
yeah.
But yeah, I just found out that while looking up YouTube links.
You know who's going to join us on the show today?
Sid?
Sid is going to be with us.
Oh, wow.
A classic interview Dan Lavransky conducted in 2007 that we will hear from Sid as he describes this incident that, you know, might have been the most famous moment of his career when you think about it. And that's not making light of his career. He did a lot of things in his career. But that leg injury, when Anderson Silva's leg snapped, it was Joe Theismann and Sid Vicious that everyone was talking about on Twitter. And maybe that's an indication of the people I follow on Twitter. But that was the comparison right away. It seems every wrestling fan has seen this graphic injury from Sid.
What would the next most memorable moment in his career be?
Sid?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, ahead of all his title wins, I would say the we're live, pal.
Oh, man.
Jim Ross. That was a pretty memorable moment.
I got a brain half the size you do.
Maybe that one. His promos were, and we're going to get a classic Sid promo later on in the show today.
Yeah.
But at this time in 2001, very, very strange times for one company known as World Championship Wrestling. Just days before this pay-per-view event, Fusion Media Ventures, which featured Eric Bischoff, Brian Bedole, and a number of investors, they had raised $63 million.
Wow.
To buy WCW.
Through Indiegogo.
$63 million, yep. And they were going to offer pay-per-views for $5.
Yeah, and a shirt.
Yeah, $100,000 for incentives. They had raised this money, and they held a press conference stating that they were going to purchase World Championship Wrestling. And there was a small little note in that press conference. They said the sale should be finalized within the next 45 days. So it wasn't signed, sealed, nor delivered.
So then why do the press conference?
They figured it was a done deal.
Oh, yeah.
$63 million. And yet, 2.5 months later, the company would be sold for about $2.5 million.
Wow, what happened?
What happened? That could be the ultimate question when you talk about WCW. But at this point, I mean, WCW, they had had the shit kicked out of them in 2000. This was a company that absolutely torpedoed during those 12 months. And here they are going into sin. They're hoping for new ownership. They were planning they would go dark for a certain period. That was one idea thrown out, and it was kind of this loose idea. They would take all their top stars off TV and then reintroduce them, the new WCW. Things would obviously not play out like that. But Sin was supposed to be, you know, the start of the rebirth of WCW. But unfortunately, they were fast on the track to death.
Yes.
What a happy time here in WCW's history.
Mm, who was the booker at this time?
At this time, this was when Russo had left. And towards the end, I think Ed Ferrara was still in there. You still had Bob Mould. I think Jimmy Hart maybe might have been involved in some stuff. They had a committee still. Maybe Ricky Santana as well, I want to say. That was kind of your team there towards the end. I mean, it was Terry Taylor, I think, was in there. So a bunch of guys booking at the time. And it seemed that, you know, watching this, you really saw this was kind of the story of WCW. You had some good stuff on the undercard, and the main event was the main event. Mm. And that was kind of a lot of your big stars had left by this point in time. Mm-hmm. Very few of them left.
Goldberg's last match.
This would be Goldberg's last match ever in WCW. Mm. Amazing when you think about things. This would be it for one Bill Goldberg. Mm-hmm. So the pay-per-view, Sunday, January the 14th of 2001. I believe this was the same week that the Fertittas and Dana White bought the UFC.
Wow.
Yeah. January 2001 was a very pivotal month in wrestling history.
It's amazing how
long. Fight history.
Yeah, it's amazing how long ago that was.
The pay-per-view starts off with a video going over the seven deadly sins of envy, greed, wrath, pride, sloth, gluttony, and lust. And each sin was coupled with a graphic of somebody. And for whatever reason, sloth was equated to a Jeff Jarrett guitar shot, and gluttony, Sid. Isn't gluttony like eating yourself to death?
Yeah. Sid seems like a pretty fit
control. Like, couldn't you have... Who was really fat at this time in WCW?
Was there like a manager?
I can't think of anyone that heavy.
No, they're all very fit.
Yeah.
In the company. When they talk about lust, they showed Scott Steiner.
Well, women lusted for him. Back in his days of wearing his shorts before the long pants.
Okay.
We'll have a big debate later over what was the worst Scott Steiner match in the month of January? Because we have back-to-back candidates.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something to ponder. 2003,
2001.
Difference of 2 years.
Yeah. This is the final version of the WCW logo. It was like, you know, they obviously had the original logo that I think everybody remembers. Then they had that star-shaped logo. And now this is like just sort of a plain-looking red block letter.
I completely forgot that they had this little dinky logo at the end of things.
Yeah, this was like sort of wasn't this like the Russo era, like the new blood type of logo?
Sure.
Whatever.
I don't know. Do you know that WCW owes me money?
Is that right?
Yeah, they do.
How?
In 2000, I subscribed to WCW Magazine with a 2-year subscription.
Uh-oh.
Stupid me. Never saw a penny. After my final issue.
How many months was remaining?
Like a year and a half.
Oh, no.
I never got it. I wrote into them. I wrote something really smarky, I bet, where I was like, I understand you have been gobbled up by your competitor.
Yeah.
What does this mean for me, the customer of said magazine? I am owed another 18 issues.
That's total bullshit.
I never got my money back.
How much would that be?
Was like... It was like $35 for 2 years of magazines. It was like, it works out to like nothing, really.
But with interest, John.
With interest, yeah. Well, I didn't have any interest in the magazine past the expiry of the company.
But that's cool.
I would have loved if WCW went out of business, but for these obligations, they still had to put out a magazine. Like, what are all these people up to now? Yeah. Hulk Hogan at home just waiting for his WCW deal to surpass, and then he can go to WWF again.
It'd be a magazine on the Alliance.
They can try and cover indie shows and where guys are working and, you know, what's happening with Kiwi.
But it's something cool you can claim forever.
I know, WCW
owes me money.
Yeah. Yeah. I will go to my grave, you know, and WCW owed me money till the end. I feel like I'm a ECW wrestler.
Yeah, exactly.
There is some high comedy, unintentional comedy throughout this show, such as the show beginning, and our announcers are Tony Schiavone and Scott Hudson. They had gotten rid of Mark Madden by this point. He was fired on Christmas Eve, I believe, of 2000. And they started it off with Tony Schiavone proclaiming, "It's 2001, and it's a brand new era in World Championship Wrestling. A real new era."
As opposed to?
I'm making the play off the TNA current slogan now. A real new era.
Oh, is that what the new slogan is?
Yeah, haven't you seen those commercials? They air on Impact every week. A real new era.
I skipped through those.
Oh. Well, it was a new era for World Championship Wrestling. It was an era titled The End. And then we have Shane Helms in the back. Sugar Shane at the time, who was with Shannon Moore. And these were the remaining members of Three Count. I guess they were Kick Out now. Two Count. And he's telling Moore that he can handle Chavo Guerrero on his own tonight and doesn't need Shannon's help. And this was, you know, as I look at the end of WCW, one of the only positive parts about the last few months that I remember is Shane Helms breaking out as a singles performer. And he was given this real big push. He was given the, what did he call his women? The Sugar Babies, I think.
Yeah.
And he had all these cool names like... The Sugar Smack was his super kick. The Nightmare on Helm Street. It's like you could tell this guy was really giving thought to all of this stuff. And he was one of the only bright spots towards the end when everything was doom and gloom. He was the EC3, maybe, of WCW in 2001.
Yeah, for sure. And I feel like, you know, he obviously would go on to greater fame in the WWE. But I do feel perhaps if he didn't have this last run as Cruiserweight Champion, he wouldn't have had a bit of that attention going into the WWE.
Yeah, and this was like, they were pushing it. Granted, I mean, you look back at this character, it's kind of goofy by today's standards, but they were pushing him as like serious Cruiserweight guy at the time, and someone to break out those neon green cargo pants that he wrestled in.
Yeah.
I used to have a pair of like yellow cargo pants like that I used to wear back in that time.
Were you a raver?
I wasn't a raver. I was just I just looked like a raver, yeah, I guess. I had like my stupid dyed blonde hair with like these yellow pants.
And earrings, right?
I looked like trash.
Flame shoes.
No, this was pre-flame shoes. Oh, okay. Couldn't do the cargo pants with flame shoes.
Did you have a wallet chain?
I did, but that was later on too. That was after yellow pants.
Interesting.
Yeah, this was all the this is all the rage.
Oh, we all have a past.
What did you dress like in 2001?
I don't know. Probably just...
I see some of the t-shirts you wear now. It wouldn't surprise me if you were still wearing those. You have some of the oldest t-shirts I've ever seen.
Yeah, my body hasn't really grown too much at all.
You have some t-shirt you said you've had since like third grade or something. Yeah. And you still wear it.
Yeah.
Like you would have been 8 years old. That's 20 years ago.
They're some of the most comfortable shirts just because they've been washed.
I can't believe it still fits you.
Yeah. Well, I guess they were a little baggy then, but now they kind of fit nice.
Were you like pretty tall for your age at one time?
No. I didn't really have a growth spurt until probably until high school, like 13, 14.
Wow.
Yeah.
Chavo Guerrero and Shane Helms was our opening match. Chavo defending the Cruiserweight title. Chavo looked about 30 years younger here than he did even in his WWF run. He had his hair here. I think that made a big...
He was younger than his WWF one.
Well, yes, I'm saying, though, by a large margin, he looked skinnier.
Yeah.
There was a nice exchange early on with Chavo going for the arm, and then Helms would counter into a hammerlock. They fought on the floor. Chavo got sent into the barricade. At one point, Chavo got into side control here and was delivering elbows across the face of Helms. Dominant position.
Oh, I guess he created that
position. Chavo the grappler here. Yeah. The crowd got into the match here, and Helms' comeback Both were down. They were getting counted out. There was a hangman's neck breaker by Helms, and then a rollover to get a two. The announcers were really playing up this match. They were completely focused on these two and getting the match across. Helms went for a sunset flip off the top rope for a two count. Then he called for the vertebraker, his move that would be banned in the WWF, and Guerrero blocks it. So Helms hits the Nightmare on Helm Street for a two count, goes for another one, but Chavo hits a bunch of knees to the head. They go to the corner. Helms avoids a tornado DDT, but then Chavo is able to get the brainbuster, and Chavo pins Helms at 11 minutes and 15 seconds. A really strong opener, I thought, to this pay-per-view.
I thought so too, and I thought it was apparent even from this match that the crowd was a pretty good crowd tonight. They were going nuts for pretty much everything these guys did.
They really enjoyed the Cruiserweights here. Very good way to start the show, and if you had turned off the show right now, best WWE pay-per-view of the year. The announcers tee up all the big matches coming up later tonight, including your favorite way, a mystery man in the main event, and only Ric Flair, the then... What was he? Because we had a match for the commissionership. What was Ric Flair? The GM, president?
Whatever's above commissioner.
An authority figure. Wow. And only Ric Flair knew the identity of the mystery man. Mike Tenay is with Ric Flair from earlier in that day, and he arrives in a limo. It's amazing how much different Ric Flair looked in 2001. Facially, he looked like Jim Helwig, I thought. And his hair was all spiked up. He looked like David Flair during his like crazy period with the hair. Look completely different than Ric Flair today.
Yeah, I mean, 10 years, especially at this point, probably will do a lot to you. But yeah, he looked way better, way younger then, of course.
Man, this event was 13 years ago.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
We say that way too much, I feel.
I know.
Wow, this was a long time. Wow, we're old. I feel like we say that a lot.
I was just going to say we're young. Hey, this was 13 years ago, and we're only 29. It's nothing.
Okay.
We're so young. It feels like yesterday, Sin.
Yeah, I mean, it really does.
It was like a few weeks ago.
Yeah. It's weird because when you talk about in wrestling terms 13 years ago in talking about this show, it actually doesn't feel like that long ago. But when you say like, oh, 13 years ago was when like the Fertittas bought the UFC.
That does that feel like a long time ago.
That feels way longer for some reason.
He says, Flair says that the mystery man, Tenay just straight up asks, who's the mystery man? And Flair replies, the mystery man is going to remain a mystery. That's the whole point of tonight's show, Mike. And he promises the guy is going to rock Steiner's world at the foundation. Which would be a faulty promise in the end.
Yeah.
Gene Okerlund is with the Mamalukes, Big Vito, and Johnny the Bull, who is banned from ringside because Vito has a match with Reno. And Vito cuts this babyface promo mentioning how Reno took his family, his house, and his girl, but he doesn't care. And then we learned that this is a brother versus brother match.
Mm-hmm.
I had forgotten these two were brothers somehow.
Yeah.
Brothers who just ended up under the employ of World Championship Wrestling. That's where they would reunite.
Yes.
Wow.
Well, there are only so many places you can wrestle for.
What a creative mother they had to name them Vito and Reno.
Those are common names, aren't they?
How many Renos or Vitos, for that matter, have you ever met?
None.
None.
But I don't live
in Staten
Island. Maybe in Italy you'll find a bunch of Vitos. Is Reno a common Italian name?
It's a city in Nevada.
Yeah. I don't know.
So we got Big Vito and Reno. Brother versus brother.
So was Reno originally part of this group, this Italian group?
No, he was never part of it. They just started. He was part of the Natural Born Thrillers,
yeah.
And Vito was part of the Mamalukes. Yeah. And then they started feuding, and they had a secret. They were brothers.
Is Reno even Italian?
I don't know. I don't know.
Could be adopted.
He could be Italian.
Okay,
it's hard to tell.
Reno just has this awful shaved head with the ponytail. You know,
Goro.
Yeah, like it's you know, when you have a hairstyle like that. It's a gimmick. It's a hairstyle that'll basically make you live your gimmick for your entire life. Like there's no walking away from your job at that point. Like everywhere you go, you're going grocery shopping. You're going up to swim. You're gonna be recognized as a wrestler.
I wonder how many times he encounters, hey, that's Reno. in 2014?
No, never. But I
wonder if you still have that hair.
I don't know, but I assume people just, you know, they'll always assume.
One of the things I found entertaining here is that whenever Reno's legacy in wrestling is that whenever some newcomer comes up and they give him a finish of a neck breaker,
yeah,
it's always, oh, it's the roll of the dice. That guy Reno. Remember Reno?
That's the extent of Reno's. I don't think anybody ever says that.
Some people do.
They'll say, yeah, they'll call it the roll of the dice, but I don't know if anybody will.
Well, the roll of the dice, that was Reno's. Yeah. That was the name Reno went with.
Because it's Las Vegas, yes. But I mean, I don't think anybody ever follows up. Oh, yeah, you remember Reno?
Let's find out about Reno. Richard Cornell, member of the Power Plant, would retire in 2003.
And I would say a definite Scott Putski candidate on this show.
Yes. Yeah, there were quite a few. There were some not-so-natural-born thrillers in that group. Mm-hmm. Amateur wrestler throughout high school before becoming a professional kickboxer. What did he do after WCW? Cornell's contract was among those acquired in the buyout after WCW. Cornell was signed to a developmental deal with the WWF after wrestling a dark match in August, defeating Mike Sanders, despite both being members of the Alliance. When was Reno part of the Alliance?
When was Mike Sanders part of it?
I don't recall them ever being on TV. From there, he was sent to Heartland Wrestling Association for more training, where he was a member of Team WCW, along with fellow WCW alumni, blah, blah, blah. He was released from his developmental deal on December 5th, 2001.
I think that's the invasion we should look at.
The Heartland Wrestling Association versus WCW invasion.
Yes.
We're coming. Wouldn't surprise me if Les Thatcher had a better invasion angle than the WWF.
Exactly. That's why I'd love to review it.
So, Scott Hudson, in putting over Reno's attributes, notes, Reno, he's done time. He was in jail.
Wow.
What a great...
Means he's a good wrestler.
Information from Scott Hudson. Vito hits a superplex.
Why don't they ever announce that in the UFC?
He's done time.
He's the victory. He has done time.
He's done time.
Yeah.
Reno gets the advantage and he's beating down on Vito. Vito mounts a comeback. He hits a underhook overhead suplex and then hits his elbow drop off the top called the Big Vito Special, which sounds like a pizza, and gets a two count. Reno calls for the roll of the dice. Vito blocks it and suplexes Reno for a two count. Reno then blocks an implant DDT and hits a T-bone suplex. And then Reno and Vito continue to go back and forth with Reno blocking a vertical suplex. And it ends with Reno hitting the roll of the dice on the counter and pins Vito at an amazing 8 minutes and 42 seconds.
The in-ring stuff I thought was all right here. But this feud, I mean, I didn't know who was the babyface, who was the heel here.
Vito was the babyface.
He was?
I think so, yeah.
Shivani here, they just really oversell this match. Like, maybe I just don't know these two well enough to care, but
it's brother versus brother way.
Yeah, well, I just
found, one's done time.
I just found that Anas is trying to sell this way too hard, like this was something that's never been done before.
It's Brett Owen and then it's Vito Reno.
Yeah.
Mike Sanders is in this weird green and black lit room. Get it? Because Chronic was in there.
Oh, okay. Right.
And Brian Adams is there. Sanders is the commissioner of WCW at this point and offers Brian Adams money because Chronic was doing an APA gimmick at this time where they were muscle for hire and says he needs
it. It was the exact same gimmick.
It was identical, yeah. They didn't smoke cigars or play poker. Okay. They smoked weed. And needs him to take care of something. He walks off and then another Scott Putski candidate, Brian Clark, wearing some god-awful orange skin-tight shirt, walked in. Adam Bomb, who looks like a bomb went off in his insides here. The guy was just protruding with veins. Says that he got a better offer and shows more money. So these extortionists are going to take both parties' money and deliver to the highest bidder.
Yeah.
This seems extremely illegal.
The whole thing is illegal.
These guys, Chronic, they're probably drug dealers. They're hitmen.
Mm-hmm.
These guys should be doing time. Next up, we have a bonus match, which it was actually considered like a selling point that this was unadvertised. And these guys got to the arena today not even knowing they'd be wrestling.
Yeah.
And then proceed to say that these four, along with Helms and Moore, stole the show at Starrcade in a ladder match. Stole the show to such a degree that they weren't booked this month on pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. And might have been the match of the night.
Oh, definitely was the match of the night.
It was this or it was the opener. Take your pick.
I'll take this.
The Young Dragons with Lea Meow.
Yep.
Get it. Against Evan Courageous and Jamie Noble. Noble spelt with a K in WCW. They would drop the K in WWF.
Noble?
Novel. And then he'd become Noble in WWF.
Okay.
So... what can we say, Wei, about this match other than Evan Courageous is another candidate and Kaz Hayashi and Jimmy Yang were just incredible.
I thought Noble was too, and I thought, you know, Courageous obviously the most limited of the four, but
never stood out, I thought, in this match. Not like he didn't hang with these guys. He picked his spots and let the other guys do the majority of the big stuff, and then you'd have Courageous do something like a 450.
I just love this match. It was just such a refreshing change from the heavyweight brawling style of the previous match.
It was such a tired style in WCW. Just like
anywhere, man. And so you get these cruiserweights coming in, just working their asses off. It almost felt like they were. I mean, it's pretty much what you would call an X Division style match today. But you know, back then they just seemed to have something to prove. Like, okay, you didn't think we're good enough to be on the show. Well, we'll show you.
And they did. I think Jimmy Yang was just criminally underused throughout his career. This guy was like 19 when he started in WCW, and it was like, man, a few years later he was the redneck cowboy, Jimmy Wang Yang.
I guess he could, you know, he could never really promo.
Well, that's unfortunate because I don't think. I mean, how important really would that have been for a guy to be in their cruiserweight division to do something?
Yeah.
But anyway, very easy to see the influence of Chris Benoit on one Jamie Noble, just in everything the guy did. Mm-hmm. Hayashi just looked great throughout this. At one point, Yang blocked a Hurricane Rana and a powerbomb off the corner, and then Courageous made a save. There was a reverse neckbreaker to Yang where Courageous hit a 450 splash. Hayashi made the save, and then Hayashi applied the Anaconda Vice to Courageous. Noble made the save, hits a tombstone to Hayashi that the announcers sold really big, and then Yang makes a save. He goes for the Yang time, and this was clearly supposed to be the finish, but he... like completely missed Noble. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't go to the pinfall and they just kind of called the audible where he delivered a small package and pinned Noble 9 minutes and 22 seconds. And then Courageous and Noble attacked them after the match. Very, very strong stuff. Even the finish thrown in there.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder, you know, why don't they do these types of matches at all in the WWE? Like these kind of spot fest matches, and I understand the complaint about those matches being too much, but I think once in a while, especially on the undercard, I find them quite welcome and entertaining.
Yeah, the WWF has just never really embraced this. Even when they did have their cruiserweight or light heavyweight division, it was always kind of, you got to work like the heavyweights and not do these kinds of matches. And this was something that always set WCW apart, was that you did get these style of matches, and one or two of them on the card were sometimes the best matches of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Buff Bagwell and Lex Luger. They show up in this ridiculously looking purple car. Both start checking out their bodies. And tonight they're taking on Goldberg and Sarge. And they have a backup plan in case their first plan doesn't work tonight, which is to get Bill Goldberg disqualified. Because if he loses, he has to leave WCW forever. And the announcers are just appalled here at these two bastards trying to undercut the career of Bill Goldberg. Mike Sanders comes out, and Scott Hudson is mocking his promos. Sanders says that Ernest Miller is going to come out and tell all the people he can get WCW back on track, just to let all the fans know that they're not on track, and says that Miller is just here for the money. He insults the audience, and then explains to us that this next match, not only the commissionership, but also Miss Jones is on the line.
Yeah, part of the contract.
Yep, leave that up to interpretation. She's on the line. She wasn't in a cage, though.
No. They had earlier, I guess it was at a previous pay-per-view, quote, the kickboxing match for the WCW commissioner.
I think we've reviewed that. That horrible, some horrible shows in 2000. That's all we can say.
So dumb.
I'm putting a moratorium on this period after tonight.
Yeah.
So Miller comes out with Miss Jones, cuts a promo, said he's going to send WCW back to the top. I understand that it would sound stupid to be saying, hey, we're number one. But at the same time, I don't need to be reminded on a show that I've spent $30 on that you are the distant number two right now in the pro wrestling landscape. Yep. And that was brought up twice here in 2 minutes. Just cuts a total babyface promo. And then they start the match. Mike Sanders and Ernest Miller, they do a yay boo spot that I can't remember seeing on a pay-per-view, but see at about every indie show. They start the match off with that. Miller gets the advantage. Sanders hits a low blow while the referee is distracted, which would be a common theme on this show. Miller then blocks the sunset flip to hit the, quote, wiggly elbow, where he wiggles and hits an elbow. And Scott Hudson notes, can you imagine what WCW would be like without Mike Sanders as commissioner? I mean, imagine the day. Way. A whole new era. Miss Jones takes a chair away from Sanders. Sanders then chases her away. The referee is distracted by all of this, allowing the Natural Born Thrillers to attack Ernest Miller, but then Chronic runs down to attack Sean Stasiak and Mark Jindrak, and then they attack Mike Sanders, put all of his money into his mouth. Meanwhile, the referee's back has been turned for all of this, and then Miller hits a running kick and pins Sanders at 5 minutes and 44 seconds, and all of the money got splattered over the mat as Ernest Miller becomes the commissioner of WCW once again.
I mean, I thought the Chronic stuff was cool. You know, oh, who paid them more for the job? Oh, it turns out it was his opponent. Big pop for the Cat.
People liked him.
Yeah, he certainly has a charm about him.
Yeah, I enjoyed him as a talker, not so much as a wrestler.
Right.
A commissioner role without having to work would have been just fine.
Yeah.
Ric Flair is with Bill Goldberg, and they're watching Bagwell and Luger's plan. Two guys that actually go back and watch stuff that happens on their own television to be aware of when something might be happening. This could really help a lot of current performers.
I suppose, yeah. But at the same time, they were being filmed, too, as they were watching somebody else's tape.
Well, they're watching on delay. So they had one of the very first PVRs.
So what if Totally Buffed got a tape of Goldberg and Flair watching them?
That would have been some really deep shit if we then cut to Bagwell and Luger watching the last segment and you keep doing it back and forth for, like, an hour. So Goldberg is just pissed here at this plan where they want to get him disqualified. So Flair says, let's make it a no DQ match. The epitome of heel turn alert, making something a no DQ. And Goldberg thanks Flair, but before he goes, Flair wants to introduce him to glaring sign number two of an angle. Can you say hi to Ben? Ben is a Plant High School kid with his father. And Goldberg comes, he meets the kid who could not have been a worse actor. Hey, Bill, can I have a photo with you? And he takes a photo with Ben, and he's on his way. Yep. Just randomly. I'm sure that's not going to play into anything later on. Bill's just a nice guy. Should have checked this kid's pockets. Okerlund is with Jeff Jarrett. Jarrett calls him Jurassic Slapnut. And he's asked about turning on his friend Scott Steiner in the main event. And he says that Steiner can trust Jeff Jarrett because they're allies here in this four-way match later on tonight with Sid and the Mystery Man. Jim Duggan comes out. He is the special referee, followed by Team Canada, who come out in the Team Canada bus, which had recently been vandalized by the Filthy Animals, but all cleaned. I had no recollection of this Team Canada bus.
Me neither.
I love the idea that maybe as a shoot they would have to travel the country in this bus.
Was this Mike Awesome's bus?
I guess so. I guess they took his 70s character and then converted it into his Canadian bus. That no one had a worse run of gimmicks in WCW than Mike Awesome. Yeah. The fat chick Thriller, mm-hmm. That was in there as well.
70s guy.
Fuck.
And what is this? This Team Canada had just one Canadian.
One Canadian. Yeah, they had Elix Skipper, Mike Awesome, Major Guns, and prior to that, Jim Duggan had been part of the group and then had left. And Jim Duggan always looks at this as just a disaster of a time period. He was always pissed that they turned him heel against his character. It was not a great time. So Lance cuts a promo saying that he's going to give the Filthy Animals Canadian justice and then get interrupted.
And Lance looked really big here.
I know. Listen, if I didn't know Lance, I'd totally think that this guy was another candidate.
Maybe it was just the grease.
Maybe, because he looked an incredible natural body here.
Yeah.
So we got Lance Storm, Mike Awesome, and Elix Skipper against Billy Kidman, Rey Mysterio, and Conan. But we can't just stop their way. We've got to have a stip.
Uh-oh.
What's... a penalty box match.
Oh, man.
My God. This is on the underappreciated, shittiest gimmick matches of all time.
Mm-hmm.
I hated this.
This was dumb.
This was so goddamn confusing. We were told that anyone breaking the rules is going to be sent to the penalty box and put the other team on, to get this, a power play, allowing the announcers to call this like a hockey game. And you would have to stay in the penalty box until a red light goes off, and it would be Duggan enforcing these penalties.
They're one-minute penalties.
Well, the announcers didn't know that because they flat out said, we don't know how long the penalties last, so they would be a minute. Skipper is the first one sent in for an illegal tag.
Ugh.
Then Mike Awesome bumps into the referee. He's sent into the penalty box, so it's 3-on-1, and Shivani proclaims that in this 3-on-1 situations, the Animals, quote, have to score this goal. Conan, then during the 3-on-1 power play, they have the man advantage where Conan power bombs Ray, or high sticks Lance Storm, by power bombing Ray onto Lance. This apparently was legal because this did not draw a penalty for the away team. Both are then allowed out of the box, Skipper and Awesome. Awesome hits Kidman from the apron. Storm then distracts Duggan. Both get penalties. Skipper at one point did that Matrix arch, and Conan just hits him with an inverted DDT. We had Major Guns and Tigress get into a brawl on the floor. Ray is not allowed to hit the Bronco Buster. This is an illegal maneuver. And somehow Kidman gets a 2-minute penalty here, as does Ray. So we had different tiers of penalties.
Hacksaw was perhaps like the most sensitive referee in the history of pro wrestling here, because I didn't even know. The technicality is that you can't touch the opponent when he's on the ropes, thus making the Bronco Buster illegal.
Are you kidding me?
That's what they were saying. That's how they're
this a guy who used a 2x4 in his matches for years. Yeah. A piece of wood.
They were unearthing all these rules about pro wrestling I didn't even know existed. And, of course, Kidman was sent in there as well because he was arguing with Duggan.
We had our gratuitous moment where Tigress just squirted the contents of a water bottle onto Tigress's, or onto Major Gun's shirt. And somehow
it
the
was
two...
Not, it was not a shirt.
What was it?
A bikini top.
Oh, okay. A bikini top. And somehow the two women who were not part of the match got penalties.
Yeah.
This is like the coaches going into the penalty box. They couldn't even make a hockey game make sense. Conan hits the X Factor after they were down 3-on-1. I'm so confused here. Kidman tags. He dives over Ray onto Storm on the floor. This too was legal. Awesome then gets a penalty when he pulled out a pair of scissors. And Scott Hudson, watching this attack, his only conclusion was he was going to give someone a haircut.
This is the wrong match to pull a pair of scissors.
Not with Duggan. This could have been the death penalty.
But he only got a minute for this.
He got a minute for attempted murder.
An illegal tag? About the same penalty as you get for pulling out a pair of scissors in the middle of a match.
This was up there with this wrestler, Big Al, who once pulled a knife on Tank Abbott during a live pay-per-view match. Oh. And the announcers just cut away because this guy went to – him and Tank went to the booker and they were like, hey, can we use a gimmick during the match? And the booker was – I think it was Kevin Sullivan was like – thought it would be, you know, a chair or something. He was like, yeah, use it. He pulled out a switchblade on him on the pay-per-view and put it up against his neck. So the Bronco Buster is eventually hit to Storm by Ray – Now the Bronco Buster's legal, I guess, because then Tigress also hits it onto Lance, and Tigress gets the penalty. Ray might have as well. Who the fuck knows? Kidman hits the Kid Crusher. Awesome makes the save. Then we got an awesome bomb to Ray. Duggan sends them to the box. Storm applies the Maple Leaf onto Kidman. And then Kidman taps. Duggan forgets to signal for the ring announcer to ring the bell. And Schiavone was confused here, saying he isn't tapping. When we're watching Kidman tap, he did tap. It was at 13:07. This is one of the worst matches I've seen in a long, long time, and easily the most confusing. This should have been built around to, like, one big penalty that would cost the heels or something. This sucked.
Yeah, this was stupid. This is really, really stupid.
And can't blame this one on Russo.
Nope. And the power plays, really, they didn't do anything to build...
No, they were completely inconsequential.
They didn't build it, do anything to build drama. They were just... In fact, like, the frequent interruptions with Hacksaw just interrupted the flow of anything they were trying to build.
I'd go so far as to say I think I hated this match the most of it. No, that's not true. I might have hated the next match more. But this was close. This was a candidate. Yeah. Mike Tenay is with the Natural Born Thrillers, who, if you weren't watching at the time, were kind of this group of power plant guys who was brought up kind of like a bigger version of The Shield, maybe. They were... very much being trying to groom all these guys. You had guys like Stasiak as well in there.
But also guys who couldn't work as well as The Shield.
They were very green.
More about their look.
Yeah. And this was quite the promo here. We have former commissioner now, Mike Sanders, who threatens Chronic, says it isn't over until the fat lady sings with Miller. Then Chuck Palumbo and Sean O'Hare, we've established they're challenging for the tag titles tonight. And we get a promo where Palumbo calls themselves the future of the industry, which I always love watching these years in the past.
He says that 5 years from now, they'll own this business.
They weren't even going to be leasing the industry 5 years from now.
I don't even know if he was even in the industry 5 years.
No, he was pretty much out by that point. And then Sean O'Hare cuts an awesome promo where he just yells that he's going to be wearing the insider's blood and yells, "Some people think I should be in jail. Well, I think they're right." Proof positive, Sean O'Hare would have many stints in jail after his time at WCW.
Well, there you go.
Mainly for assaulting women. Mike Tenay calls him a sicko. And then DDP and Kevin Nash are shown stretching. This was pre-DDP yoga. This was not exactly advanced stretching in 2001. And... they were in one of the shittiest-looking locker rooms you're going to see. This is like a hall closet or something. We got... I gotta say, one of the worst parts about these was just the formulaic nature of the setup of these matches, where they had these just terrible video packages. You had no sense of the storylines. This was nothing elaborate. It was just, well, video packages are something you have to make for every match. Mm-hmm. And they were completely tune-out packages.
Yeah. I actually did tune out.
Yeah. Terry Funk, Crowbar, and Ming for the hardcore title was next. Funk comes out, and Daphne, who was Crowbar's manager at the time, was yanked out of the crowd, and Crowbar attacks Funk on the aisle with a chair, and then they immediately fight to the backstage area and into the ladies' washroom before Ming can even get involved.
Yeah. This was like, it didn't, first of all, I don't even remember this Terry Funk run in WCW in 2001, but man, 20 seconds into this match, this 57-year-old man just starts taking these chair shots to the head.
Yeah.
From Crowbar.
The video package was most notable for seeing, I think I counted like 15 chair shots to the head for the build-up to the big unlimited chair shots to the head match that this hardcore title match was. Ming eventually makes his way into the washroom, which was great because it allowed the announcers to make washroom jokes as these guys are, for whatever reason, trying to kill themselves here. There was a trash can thrown at Ming's face. They double-team him, dropped all these tables onto him, all in the backstage area, so the crowd's just shitting on this. Crowbar climbs up onto this level and dives off to put Funk through a table. The camera cuts away, so they miss his dive. And we get a close-up of a man's arm instead of the dive. Thankfully, we did get a replay.
They cut to like one of the cameras back at the ring where the camera dude's just chilling out.
Yeah, we just get his arm. Yeah. Ming and Crowbar then fight on the ramp. Funk appears with a shovel and starts attacking Ming with a shovel, which is a metaphor for what this match was being presented as. Crowbar gets on the barricade. Then Shivani brings up Beyond the Mat to emphasize Terry Funk's bad knees as Crowbar puts a chair onto through his leg and then stomps on it. We got a figure four to Funk. Ming then splashes Crowbar off the top and then hits a pile driver to Crowbar. Another splash off the second rope to Funk. Crowbar breaks the cover with a chair. And then they start with dueling chairs to the head of Ming, which allowed Tony Schiavone to start laughing at all these chair shots.
Crowbar with the chair! Both of the chair! Oh, in the head. Again, repeated blow. Ming almost hit him. Hit me again if you will. How much more can this monster take? He's down. He's
Ming
down.
Is down.
Oh, my God.
Crowbar.
Yeah, this was after Beyond the Mat.
This was after Beyond the Mat. Yeah, that was Schiavone's takeaway. Huh. Look at these chair shots. Right to the head. Maybe he'll die. Crowbar then teases working with Terry Funk, but then clocks him in the head with another chair shot, and then Ming knocks down Crowbar, hits the Tongan death grip to Funk, and gets the win at 11 minutes and 40 seconds and wins the hardcore title. But you see, at this time, guess which one of the three didn't have a contract with WCW at this time?
It would be Haku.
That would be Haku, who exactly 7 days later would be the 29th entrant into the Royal Rumble as hardcore champion, which was never referenced, and that was the end of the WCW hardcore title.
How amazing is that?
What a run. But hey, this guy got a contract out of it from the WWF.
Yeah, good for him, I guess. Now he's working at a car dealership.
He is, so.
But man, this match, just another one of those 2000 era post-DCW, you know,
cliche hardcore matches.
Two ideas of hardcore. No creativity, no story, just guys hitting each other over the head with
lasting effects.
Yeah, just a waste of time.
Ric Flair is in the back and he congratulates Ernest Miller on winning and saying now they can control WCW. And Okerlund is then with Sid, and he was wearing a baseball hat that was about 8 sizes too small. Couldn't even fit on his head. And we got my favorite. Not only a whisper promo from Sid, but they censored the word hell.
But you gotta realize something. I am the original madman of WCW. And I'm here for one reason. To take back what is mine. And I will choke slam everyone through the ring. Straight to... standing alone, WCW champion.
Wow.
You see, I'm going to the ring. We didn't even have the up and down. This was just all down. You really had, you had to put your fucking ear to the goddamn speaker here to see what this guy was saying. Thankfully, I didn't care. He is in normal volume for our interview later. We got a video for the tag title match where they established that any four of the Natural Born Thrillers can challenge, even though we got a promo that was going to be Palumbo and O'Hare. So we got, get this, Diamond Dallas Page and Kevin Nash, who were going by the moniker The Insiders.
Huh. Clever.
Does that mean they're like, they're closeted, societal?
Closeted?
Are they just, do they not like talking to people? Are they providing dirt to like Wade Keller and Dave Meltzer? What is this supposed to mean?
Yeah,
what are insiders as opposed to the outsiders? Like what were, I get Hall and Nash, they were coming in from the outside.
Right.
And I guess DDP and Nash are now embedded in WCW. Yeah.
They're working for Entertainment Tonight. The Insider?
Oh, I get it. Yeah. Maybe.
Yo, what's that dude's name? Pat?
Pat O'Brien?
Pat O'Brien. He's the insider. Or he was until all those tapes came out.
So all of the Natural Born Thrillers come out, and Mike Sanders cuts a promo saying that they can substitute anyone they want into the match. But then Ric Flair comes out with security and says, no, they cannot. It's Palumbo and O'Hare, and the rest are ejected. So then we got a match that was designed to have two older men drop the titles and look as strong as possible. This was a TNA main event in 2014. DDP starts out with Palumbo, gives him a version of a chokeslam. Nash then comes in with O'Hare, takes a super kick, and Nash goes down. The announcers sold this like Kevin Nash had been murdered. Nash was not. He got up. He hit the snake eyes. Then DDP got in. He was distracted by O'Hare and takes the jungle kick from Palumbo. The jungle kick. So I guess this guy somehow resembled Tarzan to the announcers. The announcers are selling this as if it's a classic. It wasn't. DDP is in the corner of the heels. They were taunting Nash with DDP. Out of nowhere, Paige hits a tombstone, the second tombstone on the show, neither leading to a finish, and then makes the hot tag, if you can call it that, to Kevin Nash. The Thrillers then run down. Then Lex Luger, who just looks so disheveled, he goes into the crowd with a chair. Nash powerbombs Palumbo, and security goes after the Thrillers. Paige goes after Luger in the crowd, and then some dude with a mask runs in. It's Buff Bagwell, who hits Nash with a monkey wrench.
Yeah.
A wrench.
I don't know what the purpose of the getup was. Why did Bagwell need to hide?
Guy was already a heel at this point. It's not like this was some turn or that he was, you know.
He's wearing some, like, black outfit with a wig, and then he just comes in and takes it off. What was the point of that?
Nash is out cold via a monkey wrench. And then Sean O'Hare hits the Shauntaun bomb and pins Kevin Nash at 11 minutes and 17 seconds.
He's in! But No! Oh, the referee didn't see Buff! We've got new tag team champion! Why, Buff? Why? Why? Luger, why? What's the motivation for doing this?
The highlight being Shivani and Hudson yelling, "No! Why, Buff? Why?" And the insiders run as tag champions has ended way, and the era of Palumbo and O'Hare has begun.
I thought the ending was a total clusterfuck, but the crowd was quite hot for all of it. Oh, I thought, you know, a lot of these guys in the Natural Born Thrillers, especially O'Hare and Palumbo, actually, to me, particularly O'Hare, seemed to have a ton of potential. Why don't you think they...
I thought Chuck Palumbo and Sean O'Hare specifically, I thought they were going to have, you know, big careers eventually, especially Palumbo. I was very high on Palumbo at this time.
And why do you think they didn't go farther in the WWE?
I think Sean O'Hare, I think he was his own worst enemy. I think he just had a lot of problems outside of the ring, which are unfortunate. And with Palumbo, I can't really give you a good reason. I think he was just one of many guys that was completely... He was one of 10 million guys brought in and just overlooked. And then they tried to get him going with like this biker gimmick, and it just never took off. And it seemed like overnight he went from like this youthful looking guy to looking really old over the course of a few years. And it was just, I don't know, he had this young babyface charisma in 2000 that was not there in 2003. And the guy just never really amounted to anything. Tanae is with the Thrillers. They explain they never needed Bagwell's help to win the tag titles. And then Flair is, they cut to him. He gets into a limo and tells the guy inside, it's showtime. And clearly is not upset about the last match where he had had the Thrillers banned from ringside and then they got involved anyway. Shane Douglas comes out, cuts a promo. We have a steel chain hanging above the ring, but it's not just a steel chain match. It's a first blood match as well. So you can climb all the way up to grab a chain to lacerate your opponent. That was the thinking here. And we got a whole recap of the feud with General Rection. Man named General Rection, Bill DeMott. They explained it started over a woman and escalated. And now this is also for the United States title, not to be forgotten about here. So a U.S. title, chain, first blood match. You got all that way?
Yeah.
All right.
Over a woman. Yeah.
Who was the woman?
I don't know.
They never explained this. There's no woman in a cage. They check each participant, and the referee finds a chain in Douglas's trunks and has to remove it. General Rection does what any person would be doing going for a first blood match, an armbar.
Yeah.
To try and make his veins bleed. Rection goes to the top for a moonsault. The announcers wonder... He climbs to the top. The announcers think he's going to moonsault to grip the, to grab the chain, which would have been awesome. If he moonsaulted his way to that chain, 5 stars, 8 stars for this match. Yeah. He's going for the chain. Douglas then starts working over the left knee and goes for a figure four. And even Shivani can't keep it straight here. He's like, that is not going to win him this match, but that won't allow him to stand. This is the worst put-together first blood match I've ever seen in my life. Rection gets sent into a guardrail. At least that could theoretically bust someone open. Then Rection gets, gets crotched on the guardrail. That's what this reads. God, this character. There was a figure four on the steel post. Then Rection pulls out a ladder, which still sounds dirty, knocks Douglas in the head, climbs the ladder for the chain, but the ladder gets knocked over. Rection falls. Rection went limp. And the referee also got knocked out by this ladder falling. And then guess who has a chain in their boot? All this time, Shane had a chain in his boot. And clocks General Rection and busts him open. Wakes up the referee, who calls for the finish at 11 minutes and 36 seconds.
I found myself pretty bored, despite a lot of the unintentional comedy. But mainly due to my lack of interest in these characters. I thought the match was an okay wrestling match. But I thought it was a terrible first blood chain woman match.
How would the referee have responded if Shane had then... brought this chain out of his boot? Were DQs allowed in this?
Yeah.
It'd be a DQ in a first blood chain match.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okerlund is with Scott Steiner, the WCW champion at the time, and Medeja. And he cuts a promo about his freaks and peaks and keeping the title.
That was the extent of his promo.
That was it. Really. That was it. General Rection is having an out-of-body experience with Lash LaRue and I think The Wall. He's all bloody. AWOL, that's right. That was his name. They all had clever... Corporal Cajun. Yeah. Cajun. He's all bloodied up, and he's just freaking out over this loss. Michael Buffer... Michael Buffer's still being used here.
It's so weird to hear Michael Buffer go from introducing, like, a boxing match to, like...
WCW Sin.
These stupid stipulations.
The following matchup is no disqualification. I repeat... no disqualification.
And if Goldberg loses, his career is on the line.
For the rest of his life, he will have to leave WCW. The storyline is that he is currently 35-0. He has restarted the streak, and he has to get to 177-0 to get another WCW title shot. Oh. Boy, does that make me excited in match number 36.
Yeah.
So that's what's on the line here. It's Lex Luger and Buff Bagwell against Bill Goldberg and Brock Lesnar. Buddy Lee Parker.
Brock Lesnar.
That's who this guy was. Did you see this guy? He looked like a little Brock Lesnar. He looked like Brock Lesnar went to the bathroom and had Buddy Lee Parker.
A very tiny Brock Lesnar.
Little fire hydrant here. Luger and Bagwell come out, followed by Goldberg and Sarge.
What was the idea behind pushing Sarge, this guy from the coach at the power plant?
I don't know. It was just someone to put on the show, I guess.
No, I mean, they could have put anybody there, but why?
And they did. Sarge. They put anybody, and that's who Sarge was. Sarge came out to one of the most generic themes I've ever heard, and that's saying a lot, based on WCW theme music. He is credited as the original mentor and trainer of Goldberg. He's got a cast on his right arm, so Goldberg really knows how to pick his partners. You get the guy with the broken arm.
Didn't he break his arm after he was chosen?
Maybe, sure. Couldn't you got a substitute? Doesn't he have any friends?
Maybe not.
Hudson, this got depressing. He talked about Goldberg's original streak, winning the WCW title in front of 40,000 people and all these great moments, and... boy, did this feel like, man, all the great moments are over. Everyone's left the show, except for this guy, who Goldberg was still easily the most over guy on this pay-per-view. The crowd still loved him. Luger appears to just be a mess during this entire time period. He just doesn't even look there. Mm. And from reading his book, it sounded like he really wasn't mentally. He was just a mess. Bagwell comes in. Goldberg is no-selling, press slams him. then tags in the guy with the broken arm who can wrestle with the fate of Goldberg in his arm. The heels got the advantage on Sarge. They double-teamed him, tried to fight back, but Sarge just reverses a vertical suplex on Bagwell. Goldberg tags in. Luger then gets into the face of the backstage fan, who, luck would have it, Ben is sitting in the front row. Mm-hmm. Amazing. And Goldberg attacks Luger, and the fan is there, and the fan all of a sudden pulls out a can of mace and sprays it into the eyes of Bill Goldberg, and then flips the fan, who takes a giant hip toss ringside, and the security mauls poor Ben. Goldberg is blinded. Scott Hudson is having a heart attack watching this. Goldberg cannot see, yet he still spears Bagwell. Luger then attacks him with a chair shot to the back and then a chair shot to the head as Hudson is yelling about this, quote, jabroni fan. And then the heels, with Sarge out, they put Goldberg onto Luger's shoulders, and Bagwell hits a blockbuster to Goldberg off the shoulders of Luger. They pin Goldberg at 11 minutes and 2 seconds, and the announcers are in stunned silence. Tony, it's over. His career is done. They were talking as if the man was dead. He called them, God, Tony, this is our flagship. And they note how eerily quiet it is, as Schiavone notes that he's also had a series of concussions during his career. And this way is the end of Bill Goldberg. And it truly would be the end of Bill Goldberg in WCW.
Yeah, like at the time, this was some clear overacting from Tony Schiavone. Some classic Tony Schiavone overacting.
The hand over the mouth, turning
just,
away.
Like, yeah, just holding his head down like he couldn't believe it. It just made it look so farcical. But it actually came true. This was his last time in WCW.
My highlight was Scott Hudson in trying to convey how important this is. Was, yeah. I mean, Goldberg was our only hope. Back when the NWO was really over, he was our only hope. So Tony has to rally Hudson together. He says, okay, it's time to regroup, Scotty. We got a main event to call. And Michael Buffer introduces the real main event after this very dull video package. So we got Scott Steiner, Jeff Jarrett, Sid Vicious, and eventually the Mystery Man. Jeff Jarrett comes out and Michael Buffer introduces him. Everyone had some little catchy fact. And Michael Buffer, in his Michael Buffer voice, said, Jeff Jarrett, famous the world over for his stroke. Flair comes out and says the Mystery Man is coming, but he never said when. And this was with 10 minutes to go in the show. So the match begins, and it's a three-way. They ring the bell. The match starts with Steiner and Jarrett arguing. They then double-team Sid. Sid takes them down. He delivers those oh-so-great Sid punches.
Yours looks so bad.
The worst punches ever.
Oh, they look so awful.
Steiner hits the belly-to-belly suplex to Sid. I think we only got one of those.
Wow.
A rarity. And then Jarrett watches Steiner try for the pinfall. He's just watching here. Then we got...
They're working together.
Okay. But then Steiner did the same, where that seemed kind of weird that Steiner was willing to give up his title to allow Jarrett to win.
Yeah.
Like, I get it that Jarrett maybe is helping his buddy the champ.
Yeah,
but,
that is weird.
Sid had to walk... or run very weakly. He gets sent into the barricade on the floor. There's a belt shot by Steiner to Sid, and then another comeback with those punches. Steiner stops a powerbomb attempt to Jarrett. Jarrett comes off the turnbuckle, and this is where Steiner lets him go for the pin. The announcers are as confused as we were. Then Sid hits a double vertical suplex where he dropped these two as close to their neck as possible, and then hit a cobra cut clutch slam to Steiner. Flair is in the back. He opens up the limo. We cut to the back, and he says, it's time. And out comes some child in a children's Halloween costume, as best I can say. What a shitty outfit.
This looked terrible. This was like something you would come up with at the last minute when your kid decides to go out trick-or-treating.
Like, had a Jason mask on and this stupid straitjacket.
It wasn't even a straitjacket. It was like a jacket with the printing of a straitjacket strap on it. And then they decided to, this, you know, put black duct tape over the mask to fancy it up.
We cut back, and Sid is laying on the mat, holding his leg, his left leg, And Steiner is kicking at him. He's legitimately fucked. This is where the infamous incident happened, where it happened while they had cut away to the back.
Yeah.
The referee is conveying a message to Steiner, indicating that he's really hurt. And then Flair's music hits, and this goof walks out in his straight jacket. And he walks into the ring, and then all three attack Sid. I was feeling horrible for this guy.
And this is where, you know, you think, okay, when Anderson Silva broke his leg, first of all, he just started screaming like crazy. Match was stopped. Nobody got near him. Nobody wanted, you know, you don't touch the guy. This is like super, super sensitive, critical situation here. Get this guy to the hospital immediately. In pro wrestling, we got an angle to do. We got this mystery man coming out with the mask.
We got an angle no one gives a shit about.
We
got
to make it
look, takes precedence.
We got to make it look real. Let's start kicking the shit out of this guy.
Just unreal. You have three guys attacking a man whose leg is snapped.
It doesn't matter if your leg's fallen off. You got to carry on with your stupid storyline.
Steiner, knowing the extent of the injury, then just jumps on top of him. Quick pin. It was so weird if you didn't know what had happened. Ends at 7 minutes and 52 seconds.
The idea was that this guy... Did we even announce who the mystery guy was?
No, not yet. I was going to get to that. Because he takes the mask off.
We're going to find out who is it.
Who is that?
My God! That's Road Warrior Animal! The Road Warrior Animal is back! Where in the world did he come from? The Road Warrior! That's who Ric Flair brought in, and he turned his back on Flair. He stabbed Sid in the back. This is disgusting. You are looking at one of the most dominant figures in all the history of professional wrestling who has brought back into WCW. Road Warrior Animal, are you kidding me?
Road Warrior Animal.
Wow.
Where the announcers sell it. Oh, my God. One of the most dominant men in wrestling history.
It is so
lame. Oh,
a game changer, the Road Warrior Animal debut.
The countdown to death was on.
So I guess the idea was Road Warrior Animal was supposed to come in, and you would think that he was supposed to help Sid, but instead he turns on him. And this happened. Like, Sid broke his leg, and they decided to carry on with that anyway. So all this guy did was come in and basically tapped Sid a few times on the arm. And that somehow caused the victory.
Yeah.
That
was so the cross. You go off the pay-per-view thinking Ric Flair is just the dumbest guy in the world, but it would end up leading to a Flair heel turn as well.
No, you go off of the pay-per-view thinking that this company is
sick.
Retarded. This company is so dumb. It's just, this is one of the most awful finishes I've ever seen, and I'm not even talking about the leg break. I'm talking about how poorly this was handled just towards the end. This is really bad. And the guy didn't even have his surgery until the morning after.
Wow.
Fuck, man. Imagine trying to sleep with that thing.
I don't think he was doing much sleeping, and he was probably on morphine by the end of that.
Yeah.
So that was Sin, something that WCW committed a number of the prior 12 months going into this year, and would be their third to final pay-per-view. Two pay-per-views to go, with Revenge and Greed still to come that year. So, Sin Wei, I'm going to give it a 3 out of 10, all for the Cruiserweight matches, and for giving me some unintentional comedy in that First Blood Chain Title Woman match, which we have never seen another of.
No, we have not. I give it a 4.
A 4. All right. Well, you did make it through Sin, so congratulations, Wei.
Took a lot out of me.
Well, we're not going to take too much out of you with this Sin interview. This was from November of 2007, Dan Lavransky chatting with Sid about this infamous incident from the Sin pay-per-view in January of 2001.
Now, of all your different times, because you were back and forth between WCW and the WWF, is there any one particular period that you like over another, or is it all just kind of the same for you?
I'd have to say my last run in WCW was the best.
Really? So from that period in 1999?
Yeah.
Right. Now, what was it? What was the company like at that point to work there? Because again, that's, you know, we hear all that stuff about Bischoff and Nash and Hall and Hogan and all those guys having so much power and Goldberg. What were
that was the problem. No one needs that kind of power in this business, because then you can't do business. That was the downfall.
And how was it that those guys were able to manipulate their way to the top? Is it just that Bischoff didn't know?
How the fuck did Disco Inferno do it? I mean, I don't know. If you kiss enough ass and do enough stupid things, you know, anything's possible.
Right.
My deal is this. I don't talk to people. I come in. I say who I'm working with. I work the best I can. I do my job. I take a shower. I go home, get up, and do the same thing.
Right, right. The more I find out about that period and how mismanaged the whole thing was, I just find it amazing the way a huge, you know, multi-million-dollar company was.
No, it's amazing that something like that could be run and just be just. Well, I'm not trying to be a jerk or anything, but I think Vince is another example.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
Well, here it is. You've got a great company. There's no competition, and they're struggling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, you know, it's the old deal, and I've seen it many times in my life. There were very few people that did the opposite. Eddie Gilbert was one of them. When he was the booker, you never knew he was the booker.
Right.
So he never put anything on himself. Always enhance other people, I'm not sure if I see five more I could think of that, but Eddie was one of the better examples of that.
Right. I got to ask you too about obviously that at the Sin pay-per-view and when you broke your leg there. Me and my buddies were getting ready to do the show that night, and we're watching this pay-per-view, and you make that jump and you break your leg. I mean, my God, that was one of the most startling things I'd ever seen. Were you already hurting or injured at that point, or was it just a fluke accident?
What do you think?
I'm guessing fluke accident.
Yeah, it was a fluke accident.
So what, I mean, what must have went through your mind at that point when, you know, here you are in the middle of a televised live pay-per-view match?
Well, what I was trying to do, I knew if we could get the pin, they'd go dark. Okay?
Right.
And I couldn't get anybody to fucking do anything. And everybody panicked.
I guess so. Because you were in there with Steiner, Jeff Jarrett, and Animal, right?
Yeah, not three of your smartest people.
So they were just so freaked out by what happened, none of them knew what to do.
They weren't freaked out. What it was is, this was so stupid that the mystery partner was Animal, and he wasn't going to be my partner anyway.
Right.
So I said, y'all just go ahead and pin me. When he gets here, y'all just take, you know, just keep kicking me till we go off air.
And that was Sid, everyone, from a November 2007 interview. Wow, what a trip down memory lane that interview was going through. Wei Ting has left me, folks. He was just so upset by that Sid interview. He got up and he stormed out of the studio. He said, hey, I'll talk with you later this week. I just can't do this anymore. So I understood. Wei's been under the gun. I believe he just got into his car. He said he's going to drive to Ottawa. I don't know. I don't know what he's going to do in Ottawa, but he has left me here with the feedback that we're going to go through right now. So let's see what you had to say about Sin. From January of 2001, we start off with Tam. This pay-per-view showcased what was wrong with WCW during this time period, bad booking decisions, and main eventers who were in cruise control or simply didn't care anymore. The cruiserweight division was always a bright light through this time period, and both matches on this event showcased this. If WCW had survived, I would have loved if they had shipped out the old-timers and guys like Mike Sanders, keeping Flair, Sting, Terry Funk, and possibly DDP, and brought in guys to build up their cruiserweight division. I give this pay-per-view 4 out of 10, only saved from being a 2 out of 10 by the cruiserweight matches and the Terry Funk hardcore match. Well, that was certainly a direction that Eric Bischoff wanted to take things. Not so much eliminate all of the older guys, but understand where WCW's strengths were. And as much as the NWO is really focused upon during that 96 to 98 boom period, I mean, it was the cruiserweight matches that really, you know, ate up a lot of the minutes on those three-hour nitros or three-hour pay-per-views and were able to stand out. And especially when you look back at that cruiserweight division, that it wasn't just a cast of characters that were just, you know, spot-oriented. I mean, these were guys that went on to become much more complete characters. And when you think of who they had at their disposal in that mid-card, in 1997, it was an incredible amount of talent that they had. And towards the end of WCW, if you were still watching at that point, and there were still a lot of people watching Nitro on Monday nights, you got to see a lot of guys brought in and cruiserweights that they were going with. I mean, they didn't work at a huge expensive tip, and instead you got to see a lot of showcases from a number of these guys. As I mentioned earlier, Shane Helms was a perfect example of someone who they really got behind during the dark end of the company, but someone who I think people saw in a different light by the end of WCW. Ronaldo from Milan, Italy. Supposedly, the mystery partner was the carrot hanging from the top of the stick to capture fans into buying this pay-per-view. All we got was Sid breaking his leg by jumping from the second rope, and Animal, of all people, making an appearance despite the fact WWE and various other organizations had already made it clear in the past neither Animal nor Hawk could draw as singles players. Rest of the card was nothing special. You have to be amused at someone like Scott Steiner, whose sole reaction to Sid's injury was to keep on kicking him. And what an analogy for an organization that was barely standing on one leg by its very end. Well, that's not very nice at all, Ronaldo, but Sid was certainly not happy with the way things ended in that match, obviously. Rob from Boston. With this being a WCW pay-per-view in the year 2001, you go into it knowing that it's going to be awful, and that it is. I vaguely remembered the start of Goldberg's undefeated streak, and I'm surprised I do it all because it was a miserable failure. Chain Douglas is ridiculous. I had completely forgotten that this was the pay-per-view where Sid destroyed his leg, which just looked goddamn horrific. Wow. Time has not made that look any less painful. Finally, the addition of Road Warrior Animal as the mystery opponent, the epitome of a disappointment. It reminded me a lot of Shane Douglas's first Extreme Rising show when a masked man showed up for a run-in in the main event. The people literally left the building in droves when he unveiled himself to be Kevin Sullivan. Not that Kevin Sullivan is terrible, but to have him or Road Warrior Animal be the surprise of anything is one terrible surprise. This show is a microcosm of what WCW was at this point, a car wreck, complete with graphic physical disfigurement. Show gets 2 out of 10, and he has a rating for Sid's leg break, which he gives a 0. Well, as Wei said, I don't want to really, you know, this was a horrific injury to a man that really isn't meant for comedy. Juan from Manchester. I've been an avid listener of Review Away for quite some time. Thank you. And I just wanted to tell you guys that your WCW 1999 to 2001 reviews are always a pleasure to listen to. As bad as TNA can get, nothing will ever come close to the legendary things that WCW did during this time period. You guys should do more and more WCW pay-per-views from this time period. Well, some people think we should do less. I never like to harp on one particular time period too much, but, I mean, so much happened from 1999 to 2001 for World Championship Wrestling, and I'm with you. I've never felt that TNA has ever hit this level, particularly 2000 onwards of WCW. And, yeah, it was a time period in wrestling history that those that lived through it hopefully learned some lessons from, but most did not. Paul in the UK. Interesting show to choose a review considering TNA has just begun their new era as well. While this was still terrible when compared to what the WWF was putting on at the same time, I would say it was a step up from what we were treated to by WCW in 99-2000, though that is like throwing a deck chair off a sinking Titanic. They had begun resetting a few things and being a bit more simple. I say that loosely. Still, Road Warrior Animal is a single star in 2001 while dressed as the Zodiac Killer. Really? I don't care how powerful that single punch he gave to Sid for the pin was. Other highlights include build-up videos where everything moved at a rapid pace, Reno's little dice roll before his finisher, Mark Jindrak's black leather long trunks, and Sid's tiny denim cap. Quick question, I've heard a lot about the rumored plans for WCW following their reset a few months later, including the Big Bang pay-per-view, and apparently that a lot of ECW talent will be brought in, including Joey Styles and Rob Van Dam. Was this true, and do you know what else was planned? Yeah, I mean, at this point, they had just announced that they were going to buy the company, that being Fusion Media Ventures, and it was essentially planning out how they would bring back WCW. And one of the starts to this was taking a lot of the big talent off TV for a big return. You had Hogan off TV at this point. Goldberg was taken off after this. Then they would take off Kevin Nash the following month. So just kind of taking off all the key talent. The idea was that they would go dark for a month, and they had at least gotten into talks, because this was before Jamie Kellner had been brought in to be the head of programming for TBS at this point and the Turner Networks. So TNT, they were like, you're not going to give us Nitro for 4 weeks? Well, that we're not exactly down with that. And they were going back and forth with different relaunch dates. But there was going to be one of those grandiose Monday nights where it would be the reset of WCW, to similar to the April 10th, 2000 Nitro with Russo and Bischoff coming in. That was the idea. And to make the May pay-per-view like the big, big restart of the company. But, I mean, nothing was ever concrete. I mean, the sale wasn't even finalized. But yes, Joey Styles, I believe, had a verbal deal, as did Rob Van Dam. I mean, ECW was on its last legs at this time as well. So, I mean, a lot of talent was going to become available at this point. Plus, you had a lot of that independent talent that would get absorbed when Ring of Honor would be created 1 year later. So it was a very different business at that point. You look today at Jeff Jarrett wanting to potentially start something up, and you look at where is the talent going to come from. And there's certainly talent out there, but in terms of 2001, you not only had the talent, but they also had names attached to them, and that was key. With what you would have got out of ECW, you pretty much would have had, it's not like WWF could have taken everybody there, and there would have been a bit of a bidding war, I think, for some of this talent, because the WWF would want some, but was not going to break the bank to bring in a Rhino, for example. So, I mean, it's all looking back in hindsight, but Joey Styles was attached to it. Rob Van Dam was attached to it. I'm trying to remember other names off the top of my head, but I know for sure it was Joey Styles. Don Callis. Don Callis was going to come in. I think they were going to go with Styles and Don Callis as their commentary team. Next up, let's go to Vince from Vaughn. I gave up on WCW shortly before the pay-per-view. Watching it now, this is my first go-around with WCW Sin. This show wasn't that bad. Okay, the main event was a complete suck-fest, but I found the mid-card entertaining. The Vito-Reno match looked like it was just going to be two bulls butting heads, but turned out to be a half-decent match considering their massive bulk. I popped big time for the superplex, did not see that one coming. I even liked the penalty box thing. Sure, it looks stupid, but the more I thought about it, the more it made sense. I don't know about that. Wrestling referees have no real authority to manage wrestler behavior. The penalty box gave the ref some element of authority. I give this show 7 Rey Mysterio hair horns out of 10. One of the many brilliant decisions in those final few years, unmasking Rey Mysterio. Rich will be our final piece of feedback today. And he says, I must sadly admit that I was following WCW rather closely during this period, not entirely by choice. I was going to college at the time, and the only other wrestling fan in the dorms was a football player with large muscles and no TV of his own, whose idol was Scott Steiner. He was such a big fan that he had to help me bleach his goatee and dye a black stripe down the middle of it so he could look like Big Papa Pump. I shit you not. I was just happy to have another fan to watch wrestling with, so I was willing to watch WCW on Monday nights instead of Raw. Anyway, as for the actual show, I can remember being curious and somewhat foolishly excited about finding out who the masked man was that Ric Flair was bringing in, hoping it would be someone that could hopefully spark some interest in the company and possibly save it. When I found out the next night on Nitro that it had been Animal, it made me think of a child on Christmas Day waiting to open the biggest gift last, thinking the biggest must be the best, only to open it and find a set of encyclopedias. That's a hell of an analogy when it comes to professional wrestling and mindsets. Having said that, I want to thank you guys for doing this podcast every week. I always look forward to them and hope the launch of the WWE Network will provide for some new reviews and make things easier for you. Well, folks, we don't do this because it's easy. We do this because hopefully there's enough of you listening that enjoy it. So thanks, everyone, for your feedback. You can always post it at lawradio.proboards.com. Each and every week, we do shows right after Raw, right after Impact, and then a nostalgic review each and every Wednesday with whatever way and I feel like. And those are just some of the shows you can check out here on the ever-expanding empire of live audio wrestling shows. So we will be back on Thursday night with Review and Impact. Waiting will be back, I promise, on Thursday night, and for Review Away next week, which we're going to kind of stay in the 99 to 2001 wrestling boom period, but we're going to be maybe more generous next week because we're going to watch the company that was kicking ass at this time, and that was the World Wrestling Federation. And we had never reviewed this edition of Raw. It took place on February the 8th of 1999 from the Sky Dome in Toronto, the first ever Raw to take place in the Sky Dome. Actually, would turn out to be the only Raw to ever take place at the Sky Dome in Toronto. So we're going to review that next week from February of 1999. It would actually air the following Saturday because of the Westminster Dog Show, if I'm not mistaken. Whatever. Something was on Raw that night, and they didn't air it in the U.S. It aired in Canada, and I was at this show. I spent $75 buying a ticket from a scalper with my buddy, and we went to this show and got to sit right next to the ramp, and I nearly got a sunburn from the Brood's entrance. So it's a two-hour Raw, which is a breeze to watch. We're going to chat about it next week, and we'll also take your feedback on the show. So go to lawradio.proboards.com. The feedback thread will be up later. Engage. Talk with some other fans on the message board. Get acquainted. Catch all of our shows. Chat about them. Tell them why you don't like John Pollock. It's a great bonding experience. And in the meantime, lots of shows up right now. The Law from Sunday night, running through the Royal Rumble with phone call after phone call after phone call. I can't remember such a unanimous opinion. And then, of course, Monday night, Review a Raw is up as well with myself and Brian Mann chatting Monday's show from Cleveland. And we will be back Thursday night with Review and Impact. You can follow me at I Am John Pollock on Twitter. You can follow Way at Way, WAI0937. And as well on Instagram at Law Radio, liveaudiowrestling.com. And you can subscribe and get each and every one of our shows for free on iTunes. Just look up The Law, Live Audio Wrestling. So let's go out with a song here to really encapsulate things here and sum up the past hour or so that we just spent discussing Sin. You know, 2001. What comes to mind when you think of 2001? I'm going to go back to our good old Billboard charts. 2001, Billboard Top 10. All right, well, here are the top 100 songs of 2001, and I can't believe this was the number one song of 2001. This was on the list of Billboard's top Hot 100 songs of 2001, and I don't think I could possibly think of a better song title to properly summarize WCW in January of 2001. We'll chat with you next week. Chasing after you, I'm falling even more in love with you. Letting go of all I've ever longed to. I'm standing here to tell you, man.